in secret with the collusion of squads of corporate lawyers. These pacts, like the pacts contrived in the past, are not free trade agreements. They are investor rights agreements, insurance for corporations that the conditions being created will guarantee profit. Why does this need to be done in secret? Because the conditions that benefit them fuck us right over. They spy on us, they lie to us, they control us with violence, they sell us shit food and annihilate the planet, and all for a little bit of money. I wish they were lizards. That would make more sense. Certainly they are manifesting a reality that comes from reptilian consciousness, in that selfishness and greed are short-sighted survivalist impulses that are outmoded and must now be upgraded. The next bit of Chomsky's is so wicked, I'm not even going to patronisingly translate it into colloquial prose. Just mainline neat gnome straight into your synapses. Here he just gives it to us straight. There is, in other words, ample evidence that securing state power from the domestic population and securing concentrated private power are driving forces in policy formation. What Chomsky has done is spelled out for us like we're children or layabouts or P.G. Woodhouse characters who would sooner pootle about in our jalopies than stare the stark reality of our virtual slavery in the face, is that we're being fed porky pies by a bunch of hell-bent swines. Chomsky demands that we accept our role as sentient adults, citizens, with fearless, ruthless, mechanical dexterity. He exposes the absurdity and disingenuousness of the dominant narrative. In this next paragraph, another that I'm loath to meddle with, he very simply demonstrates that our authorities, those in power, those who set the agenda, are not acting out of the paternal benevolence that they claim guides them. Check it. Take two prominent current examples, global warming and nuclear weapons. As any literate person is doubtless aware, these are dire threats to the security of the population. Turning to state policy, we find that it is committed to accelerating each of those threats in the interests of the primary concerns, protection of state power and of the concentrated private power that largely determines state policy. Global warming is totally real. It has been empirically proven, and the only people who tell you it's not real are, yes, people who make money from creating the conditions that cause it. We're reaching the end of Professor Chomsky's contribution. I was intrigued by his inclusion in his essay of this quote from General Lee Butler, the last commander of the Strategic Air Command, which was armed with nuclear weapons. "We have so far survived the nuclear age by some combination of skill, luck, and divine intervention, and I suspect the latter in greatest proportion." Whether you believe in God or not, it is interesting to hear a military general in charge of nuclear weapons ascribing our avoidance of Armageddon to a higher power. I do believe in God, as must surely be abundantly clear. The more I learn, the more I experience, the more certain I become. Perhaps the persistent belief that there is something else, some force that supersedes and governs, is simply derived from the ghostly knowledge that behind our own being is a separate and autonomous system that digests our food and pumps our heart and converts oxygen. It seems that those that reach the higher echelons of our man-made structures or delve deeply into science become initiated into an awareness of a nameless beyond. Indeterminate human cells suddenly and invisibly triggered into purpose, no one knows why. No one knows when the soul alights upon these cells. No one knows the formula for consciousness. No one knows why our destruction has as yet not been permitted, and even the men with their fingers on the button ascribe it to God. Noam Chomsky is a too fastidious, diligent and brilliant a man to at this time in his life of peerless truth-telling cry revolution, but this final paragraph to me suggests but one course of action. As we are all surely aware, we now face the most ominous decisions in human history. There are many problems that must be addressed, but two are overwhelming in their significance: environmental destruction and nuclear war. For the first time in history, we face the possibility of destroying the prospects for decent existence, and not in the distant future. For this reason alone, it is imperative to sweep away the ideological clouds and face honestly and realistically the question of how policy decisions are made and what we can do to alter them before it's too late. Thanks, Noam. I'll take it from here. So, we're fucked unless we organise and disobey. They've got this sewn up. They own both the teams that are competing, the stadium they play in, the grass they play on, and we're the ball they're kicking around. They have removed all possibility for reform or redirection within the system. The change must come from us. Our only hope of survival is to overthrow their structures and take our power back. Chapter 31, Be the Change. Of the successful revolutions we've thus far discussed, the one we ought most emulate is the Spanish Revolution. One thing we don't want to do is replace one ruling class with another. We want power to be shared, not concentrated, and the role of the diminished state to be administrative and responsive. The means by which we achieve this too is important. Perhaps there is a corollary between the violence that brings about revolution and the corruption that tends to follow. The Indian Revolution was a roaring success but took ages. I always thought that the British colonised India and thought of it as being tied up with our empire, which in spite of everything I've written, I am still programmed to be a bit proud of. However, it was a blag. India was controlled by the East India Company. Queen Victoria and all that mob were just the Ronald McDonalds of the day, weirdly dressed clowns to look at while the real caper took place out of view. Or maybe she was a brand ambassador like Scarlett Johansson, knocking out soda streams on the West Bank to make the persecution of Palestinians seem all sexy and fizzy. Legal asterisk! Scarlett Johansson has sued people before for defaming her. I bet she's a lovely, well-intentioned human being, and for a number of reasons, I wouldn't like her to feel that I'm criticising her. It just shows how tangled the entertainment world and corporate world are. Legal asterisk. Scarlett Johansson sued a French novel because the lead character was too like her, so we have to be super careful. To be clear, as far as I know, she ain't sued anyone re-SodaStream. I'm not criticising Scarlett. I'm a man and have the same motivations as all men when addressing her. She is pretty, and I want her to like me. Please, can this matter rest? I think with brands and their branding that if you want to understand the truth of what they are, you have to first look at what they're telling you, then track back from that point as far as you can and you'll be closer to reality. So with a monarch like Queen Victoria representing the brand of Britain and its economic interests, what is the message they're giving us? Firstly, respectability. This woman is super stiff. She never smiles. She's serious and well-behaved. Secondly, authority. Listen to their jingle, God save our Queen. She's tied up with God. That means divinely sanctioned. The Americans must have nicked that idea when they took the lingo. Everything about the empire screams respectability, legitimacy, authority, and permanence. Using my theory, we must move as far away from that as possible, and we'll be closer to the reality that they are masking like a tramp smothered in deodorant. So then, the British Empire was not respectable. We know that now. They were vicious thugs using violence to get their way, reneging on deals and nicking the resources of whole nations. Are they legit? Of course not. The whole Christian mythology they loosely appropriated while still clinging on to bizarre pagan symbols like lions and unicorns and pyramids is all about empathy and sharing. What a swizz. Is there any real authority? No, only that which is achieved through coercion and violence. And as for permanence, where the fuck is it now? The same is true for Coke or Apple or any of them. If they sell you community, they are in fact individualistic. If they sell you youth, they are steeped in decaying tradition and antiquated ideas like materialism. How can Coke, a brown drink with too much sugar in it, represent coolness or youth or America or sex? How can Apple, a bunch of needlessly elaborate, too frequently updated, deliberately expiring digital pools for cyber narcissism, do anything but lock us into binary solipsism? How does it create community? Legal asterisk. Our lawyer Roger, who's decent, says Apple do not make deliberately expiring goods. Online, there are many accounts of glitchy downloads that appear to make iPhones stop working correctly. I have a terrible time personally with my iPhone. He's like an evil Knight Rider, losing emails, sending nude photos into cyberspace, a proper little troublemaker. Legally, though, I cannot prove that Apple engage in planned obsolescence, though this practice is extremely common in the tech industry. Like most things in this book, you can do your own research and draw on your own experience. But so you can see once more how powerful this system is and how its parameters are rigidly enforced, not by master Illuminati, but by nice professional people just doing their jobs at a publishing house. I'm obliged to tell you candidly that Apple do not make deliberately expiring products. Any corporation selling us products on the basis of anything other than utility should be revoked and shut down. Any corporation that at this time of fast diminishing resources designs products that have inbuilt doomsday devices, planned obsolescence, should be shut down. All this glamour and clamour and blagging and skanking has to end. Legal asterisk. In God's holy name, by all the saints, I swear by the blood of Christ that I am not referring to Apple here, but to other companies who I will not name as to not add to the complications that you encounter when trying to confront Mammon. You will see the company's names when you search planned obsolescence. Also, like me, you will be astonished how frequently Apple's name comes back in the results, especially as you weren't even searching for it. There must be some reason for that other than Apple engaging in planned obsolescence, though, as we all know, and I swear by the name of Allah that there is no proof that Apple have ever engaged in any of that. This drink will fuck you from your gums to your guts, but cold enough the sugar and fizz will provide a blip just long enough to stop you opening a vein. Coke. Or Pepsi. Doesn't matter. This phone will connect you to people everywhere except for where you are and sever you from God forever. Apple. You've seen their logo. It's an apple with a bite taken out of it. That bite is the symbol of the moment mankind broke their pact with God, transgressed their own innocent nature, and chewed into consuming and consumerism. We have externalized all wonder, materialized our inherent magic. There is an old river where I write. It's grimy and dirty and ancient. From a distance, it's all very chocolate box, swans and cygnets, willows weeping and long grasses. When you stand on the bank, though, it's brown and full of pungent gunk and natural funk, and it's cold, British cold. As I plunge in, my skin tightens and I stare. I reach for strangled breath. Forgotten capacities stir and a noise I've never heard emerges, a roar, an animal roar, unrefined and naked. Unexplored depths and vibrations neglected and unstirred. We are nature. We are nature as we munch gum and check the phone. We are nature as we queasily regret our imperfection, turning the glossy page, turning our glossy stomachs. We are nature as we hear them whitter inanely on the radio, desecrating the silence with the violence of their idiocy and dumb verdicts, chattering and grooming, picking through the ticks in their hair, marvelling at new minutiae. These boys that throw off Birmingham for Baghdad, what are they looking for there? What's in that crimson desert that they can't find in the ballroom? Untangled from Spaghetti Junction and aspiring to Spaghetti Westerns, these loaded kids of Charlton Heston declaring their jihad. To end this hapless meander through a mapless expanse, a hopeful and myopic grope, a listless, disconnected kiss smothered like Magritte's shrouded lovers, whose hand can guide us through this abyss? What cartographers of consciousness can we look to now? I'd take Gandhi over ISIS when it comes to making maps for new worlds. Gandhi is a bit of a placeholder hero for me, a kind of unthinking grab for an easily identifiable brand of hero. Einstein said of him, "Future generations will scarce believe one such as he existed." My own love of him is founded upon early exposure to the film in which, scene after scene, he challenges authority and stands up to corruption and bullying. Gandhi knew too that defiance had to come from somewhere other than rage, that you can't build love from hate, that the world we live in is the manifestation of a sublime source. The most practical application of what a lot of people would regard as wishy-washy claptrap was his popularisation of non-violent protest. Gandhi organised the Indian people around this principle, total civil disobedience and non-violence. Gandhi deplored violence but hated cowardice more, so walked face first into a bloody good hiding from British colonial forces during his decades-long leadership of the campaign for self-rule. When we think about former colonial nations campaigning for self-rule, we can see the legitimacy of their demands. They only want to determine their own lives without constantly being exploited and controlled by an invading economic power. Perfectly reasonable, we conclude. Today, in our apparently free Western secular democracies, we live under a tyranny that is only superficially distinct. The only connection that, say, David Cameron can claim is that he was born on the same landmass as the majority of the people his party governs. But as we now know from the contributions of Chomsky, Graeber, Norberg, Hodge and Goldsmith and our intuitive understanding of life, our governments are not accountable to us, but to transnational corporations. Is that really any different from the Indian people being exploited by the East India Company, give or take a few Xboxes? There's a lovely bit of Pathé newsreel footage of Gandhi in Lancashire and East London when he came to Britain in the 40s to mug off Churchill and everyone with his pithy lyrics and demands for self-rule. "What do you think of Western civilization, Mr. Gandhi?" "I think it'd be a good idea," he said, the rascal. Like any dignitary, they've dragged him round the joint, meeting folk and seeing sights. I like to think Gandhi went, "Yeah, I like the Tower of London and that. Can I meet some real people now?" Who knows? Regardless, when you see Gandhi with the female mill workers of Lancashire, whose livelihoods his ideas threatened, he didn't want pointless importation of textiles from Britain that had been sent from India, manufactured, then sent back for profit. He wanted Indian folk to make their own stuff. You can see the workers really dig him. Even though he's a mad-looking little Indian bloke all dressed up in a nappy, only in England to fuck off the empire and superficially negatively impact them, the women know a kindred spirit when they see one. They know that Gandhi is fighting for the rights of the oppressed against the powerful, a struggle they know well. The insight of these women, the inherent connection shared between the world's exploited people in the struggle for autonomy, matters now more than ever. We can no longer dopily believe that we have more in common with billionaire warlords and their slick white political acolytes than the populations of the nations that they're up for bombing this week. Shoplifters of the world unite and take over. Morrissey's mid-80s wail, the administratively unlikely rallying cry for the world's dispossessed to organise the way they have organised to ensure their hymn sheet is the one we end up singing from. According to Chomsky, the hijacked ghostwriter of the last chapter, revolutions that concentrate power in the hands of a new elite are pointless. Revolutions that spread power across society succeed. So let's review the situation. We know the world needs to change. We're on the brink of destruction. We know the majority of people, I would argue everyone, would benefit from revolution. And we know what has to change. Corporate tyranny, ecological irresponsibility, and economic inequality. We know how to change them. Remove all the systems that contravene Buckminster Fuller's theorem, trade agreements, monopolies, unrepresentative democratic institutions. We know to a degree what will replace them, localised self-governing communities and businesses. Do we know 100% what this will look like? No. We don't know if there will still be some inequality, some hierarchies, some conflicts. We do know that there are alternatives and we can no longer remain pallid and listless in the cellar like Fritzl's kids, unaware that there's a big wide world out there where getting raped by your dad isn't mandatory. The democratic models that some of our contributors have mentioned are contingent on participation. This is where we really address the accusation that the withdrawal of participation in fraudulent democracy is apathetic. It's not don't vote, watch porn, it's don't vote, build your own system. Have you ever participated in any horizontal, non-hierarchical organisations as they make plans? I have. It's really challenging. Everyone has something to say, and everyone has their own version of what would be best. After about 10 minutes of trying to fairly and democratically organise a charity event in a committee of 12 where everyone has an equal voice, I want to shout, "Oh, fuck you lot, I know what I'm doing, we're doing it my way." The ego marches to the forefront and tries to seize control. And it's not just my ego, they all have egos too. Everybody's ego wants to be heard. It's like a dog park where we, the human owners, stand back and watch our canine representatives sniff arse and yap. Quickly, you realise that your job is to negotiate with your own ego and let collective power that is not allied to any individual govern. Hand over your power, trust the common consciousness guided by consensual trusted principles to be the authority. This is not a lethargic and laissez-faire process. It is dynamic, time-consuming, and requires patience. We will probably always require some form of representative democracy. It just has to be the two things that that conjunction implies. Representative, the people's will is represented, and democratic, entirely answerable to the electorate. When you look at the House of Commons or Congress, the reason you feel bored and disengaged is because you know it is a masquerade. The exceptions, the Tony Benns and Caroline Lucases, are well-intentioned dinghies bobbing along in an ocean of treachery. That is why I do not vote. That is why I will never vote. Let's instead participate in a system that is truly representative. In the next chapter, we're going to look at some stuff that, if we don't really concentrate and determinedly remain upbeat, could get all boring, and we hate that. The fact is, though, if we're to shut up Paxman and the Naysayers, good name for a band, we have to show our working out, like in a boring maths GCSE, which I knew was pointless, even as I was failing it. Chapter 32. Help me help you. Here are the principles of a successful worldwide leaderless anarchist collective with millions of members that helps people to deal with substance misuse issues and is defined by anonymity, so as you will see when you read it, I am forbidden to declare whether I belong to or not. They are known as the 12 Traditions. I believe that this social code has much in it that we can replicate and benefit from. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon our unity. This first edict establishes an important spiritual principle. Our power is in unity. We must always prioritise our collective well-being above individual advantage. If you look at the way the world is currently governed, it runs almost diametrically averse to this mandate. Individual success and happiness is prioritised through the prevailing consumer mentality and the dominant elitist capitalist system. These shady secret trade deals that Chomsky told us about are like white phosphorus-tipped arrows in the heart of this principle. Fuck the world, fuck community, show me the money. So when we're holding a group meeting on how our community should be managed, no individual would have the right to do anything that fucks on a micro level with the group or on a macro level with the planet. On a lighter note, I was once in the back of a limo with Tom Cruise, oh yeah, I've lived baby, and he was talking to me about acting and he told me how he approached the character of Jerry Maguire, who said the famous "Show me the money" line. His kids were opposite us and we were trapped in a luxurious carriage of beige leather. He said the comedy of Jerry came from his frustrated enthusiasm, a man who believed powerfully in what he was doing but was constantly thwarted. "Help me help you," said Tom all passionately. In this moment I thought, wow, I'm in a car with Tom Cruise and he's doing bits from his films. How cool! I looked around the car to see if I could get a reciprocal bit of eye contact from someone, you know, like, "Hey guys, this is mad, he's doing that thing." But everyone else in the car was either Tom Cruise or Tom Cruise's kids, so they weren't as impressed by it. In fact, they didn't notice it. So I changed my whale face to a normal nodding, smiling face and thought, I'll just have to put this in a book one day if I'm going to get any juice out of it. I hope when I do, it doesn't seem like an extraneous name drop. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. I love this idea. No individual has authority. The group has authority. The group conscience is expressed through voting. If I turn up and say, "I'd like a big statue of me erected in the town square, and as leader of the group, I'm going ahead with it." Everyone else can say, "Well, that's a nice idea, Russell. You've been a good leader, arguing our case at the regional meetings and nationwide meetings. Let's see if a statue is a winner." All those in favour press the green button. All those against press red. If for some crazy reason there are more red votes than greens, I don't get my fucking statue, and that's that. This principle reminds Rumsfeld or Ed Balls or whichever risible dope in a suit trying to wangle a conservatory or new pair of shoes out of a role in public office that we, not they, are in charge, and you only get to act on the will of the people. So if the people don't want a war in Iraq, no war in Iraq. The bosses, the people, through the group conscience, have spoken. Legal asterisk. Ed Balls didn't specifically get a conservatory or a pair of shoes. For all I know, he didn't claim anything dodgy. I was joking. I happen to know that Ed Balls is in politics as a result of a powerful yearning to help others. He is a political Saint Francis. He did charge his £2,000 removal van to expenses and flipped his home 3 times in 2 years. Sort of thing Saint Francis might have done. 3. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. This requires a bit of translation. What it means is it don't matter what gender, sexual persuasion, colour, religion or class you are, if you want to join the group, you can. I suppose on a global level, there will be groups that want to define themselves through specificity and exclusion. The English Defence League or the Nation of Islam might want their own setup. I suppose we'd have to tolerate that. I mean, we can't phone up the nation and say Bill O'Reilly wants to join up. You've got to let him in. That might be antagonistic. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or our organisation as a whole. This tradition definitely deals with the above problem. Have a racially, religiously or sexually defined and exclusive group if you want, but you can't mess with our necessary overall objective of ecological responsibility and economic equality. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Our primary purpose is the preservation of our environment and the creation of a harmonious and inclusive democracy. We can likely only achieve this through small, self-determined communities that are run voluntarily and democratically. 6. A group ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. This prevents people trying to profit from communities designed with spirituality in mind. We're all flawed and greedy and egotistical, so we have regulations in place that acknowledge that and guide us back to the better part of our individual and communal nature, our altruism, our empathy, our creativity. 7. Every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. This is designed to prevent top-down authority asserting itself. The group is independent and democratically run. This tradition, even the word tradition is nicer and less incendiary than the word rule, prevents swaggering capitalists and glamorous nitwits acquiring authority through financial means. 8. Our organisation should remain forever non-professional, but our service centres may employ special workers. This reminds me of Matt Stoller's no titles policy. No one can suddenly claim to be a professor of revolution or an admiral of equality. To quote myself, always the sign of a well-managed ego, those in government are administrators. Those in municipal positions are servants. Our relationship to the police or traffic wardens, should the community vote for such institutions, are not subordinate. They are horizontal. 9. Our organisation as such ought never be organised, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Remember what Adbusters said about corporations. They used to be set up to do a job, then disbanded, then for no other reason than profit and individual advancement, they became ongoing, immortal, money-guzzling entities. This tradition prevents that. We set up a committee to build a nice juice bar or hold a World Cup, and when it's finished, it's disbanded. Ta-da, Sepp, glad you enjoyed it. You can stand for re-election in 4 years. We'll let you know. 10. Our organisation has no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. This principle ensures the autonomy of other groups. Clearly, our ideology is defined not by us wanting to be free from boozing one day at a time, but free from our addiction to a corrupt and corrosive system. We are addicted to destructive ideas. When consent is achieved on our collective agenda, we can then determine what the incontrovertibles are. Likely, they are based on ecological responsibility and individual freedom. I know what I'd like, but that's probably different from your requirements. As long as we both know neither of us has a hotline to God or inherent superiority, we should be cool. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. This principle is dangerously close to being transgressed right now. You'll note that I haven't declared my affiliation because were I a member of organisations defined by these traditions, I'd have no right to. What is implicit in this principle is the obligation to make your primary focus your own conduct, not telling other people what to do. Another big challenge for me personally. I love giving advice on how to change the world. It's much harder to get on and live like a good man. How effective and beautiful to have a tradition to remind us of this. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Here we see that the titular anonymity which defines these organisations is not solely in place to prevent sloshed old drunkards getting embarrassed by their condition, rather to emphasise that individuals are all equally valuable and equally expendable. I like this principle very much as it returns to the primary battlefield where revolutions must be waged, our own consciousness. It's not that I want to oust David Cameron or Barack Obama or Angela Merkel. It's that we must collectively overcome the structures that promote the egocentric in all of us. Me and you and David Cameron and everyone else have to individually yield to the divine within us so that collectively we can manifest a society worthy of beautiful beings. One day, David Cameron's ego might be playing up, but that'll be okay, because collectively we have a system that can avert that. Another day I might get flash. That doesn't matter, because we have principles in place which prevent anybody's negative nature becoming dominant. Tyranny is the deliberate removal of nuance, said the filmmaker Albert Maysles, when an institution or an individual oppresses truth to ensure that their version of reality dominates. Whether that's Philip Morris removing the nuance of the carcinogenic properties of different types of fags to perpetuate sales, or me deceptively managing information within my own relationships, or the gun lobby insisting that guns shoot peace out of them, not lead. We have a culture where principles mean nothing and personalities mean everything, and I can see why it caught on. I've done very well out of it. My personality allows me to get away with all sorts of rubbish, riding the wrong way up a one-way street on a stolen bicycle. I didn't steal it, though. I bought it off a dodgy bloke. Winking at the police as I pass. Years of trouble-free promiscuity, tables at restaurants, but without principles, I was freewheeling away from God. Here are some more examples of ideologies that flout the establishment's insistent jingle that their way is the only way. So, many corporations will be killed, according to Adbuster's excellent suggestion. Perhaps we should use the word cull, like people do when they want to kill something cute. Are you killing that badger?
No, sir, culling it.
When you've finished culling it, will it be dead?
A bit, yes.
So explain the difference between killing and culling? Well, it's a you. In a sort of tuneful sense that the creature is being gently lulled to death rather than killed with a hammer. And what's the hammer you're holding for?
Culling.
So maybe we should cull some corporations. Once we've culled them, their resources and materials can be returned to communities to run themselves. Outlined here is a suggestion for how a corporation could be structured more fairly. Employee Investment Funds, Sweden, 1970s. Every large Swedish corporation had to give its employees shares equivalent to 20% of its profits every year. Well, that's novel, the empowerment of workers within a corporate structure. Sure, it's limited, 20% isn't enough. The workers should have 100%, and there should be no hierarchical distinction between any of the workers, regardless of their costume. Title abolition will help towards that. We've begun negotiations. Good. Well done, Sweden. The shares were not owned by individuals, but were controlled by regional management boards, which were democratically accountable. Fair enough. We're not after a new elite. Collectivisation and lateral autonomy. Cool. No wonder Volvos are so safe. The boards had to use shares for social priorities and the public interest. That's good. I mean, I think huge sectors of the financial industry will be entirely dispensed with, given that the whole thing is an elaborate mathematical metaphor designed to legitimise fraud and theft. Nice to know that if any form of market did remain, there'd be no unaccountable bankers getting bonuses during an economic crisis that they caused. Viva IKEA! As the shares of the companies grew, so did the influence of the workers' management boards on corporate decision-making. Clever. The destiny of the board and workers are inextricably linked. From what we've discovered so far, this structure still seems a bit hierarchical, but at least it proposes a form of empowerment for workers which we could easily amplify. ABBA forever! Unfortunately, this scheme was never put into place due to widespread hostility from employers. Oh, right. They never actually did it. It was a hypothetical corporate revolution. Typical. The sauna-dwelling, porn-watching, suicide-committing pervs. Understandable, really. It's a method of financial reform that could never be imposed without union power and regulation that modifies the power of corporations. Bloody ironic. Even though I think this measure is too modest, look at how it would have an impact in a country like Britain on a company like Tesco. In 2014, Tesco posted profits of $3.3 billion. Under the aforementioned system, they would have to transfer £660 million to the Employee Share Trust, meaning they would still keep £2.64 billion. Well, they can't moan about that, can they? They'd still get billions in profit. Let's pause to recall that profit means surfeit money that you don't actually need after all your costs have been covered. We know that for profit to exist in one place, deficit has to exist elsewhere. So I don't think this goes nearly far enough. Nonetheless, let's look at how this modest reform would impact Britain. The Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham cost £545 million to build in 2010. You'd have more than that amount to spend every year just from one company, and they'd still get to keep 80% of their profits. Wow. That means that corporations that make huge profits with a modest amendment could be making life-saving contributions to the society they profiteer within. That seems so reasonable, fair, apposite and just. Hey, how come not one mainstream democratic party anywhere in the world has policies like that? Why could that be? Why aren't Labour or the Democrats or even self-declared people's parties, they're all meant to be people's parties by the way, like UKIP proposing gentle, effective regulation of corporations? Unless they're all utterly supplicant to corporate tyranny. Oh yes, that's it. So that's one idea that in my view is a piece of pipsqueak reformism and not worth dying for, that no party in the democratic space would ever propose because it conflicts with what Chomsky outlined for us earlier as the true function of power, to protect itself and to control us. What the above example does is demonstrate another alternative to the way things are and shatters the convenient lie that there are no alternatives. Here's another example of things being run differently. This time it's truly representative democracy. That means something worth voting for. A system that actually means the will of the people can be manifested. It's called participatory democracy. In Porto Alegre in Brazil, a city with a population of 1.3 million, 22% of whom live in shanty towns and slums where typically people aren't that well educated or affluent, large-scale participatory democracy has proven to be very successful. Since 1989, the expenditure for the whole city has been designed as an annual participatory budget so people can decide how the money is spent. That seems unfeasible. All these slum-dwelling city of gold emulating barefoot with an orange football on the beach folk are each year involved in the economics of their community. It can't be done. All right, how is it done? In March, there are micro-level discussions in preparation held all over the city. Okay, so people understand that they are part of a community and can take part in its management. In April and May, assemblies are held to decide on priorities for the coming year. I see, so the first meeting is to establish priorities. Some people might want to have more regular refuse collections, others might want more community housing, others might be worried about immigration. Bring it up at the micro meeting, work it through, then take it to the assembly the following month. 48 delegates are elected from the assemblies to attend the budget council. So there's a representative element, but it doesn't feel as dislocated as our politics. There's a sense that you are making decisions that will affect your life. I bet if we were able to present that information interestingly, people would be as engaged by that as they are by dancing on ice. The requests of the citizens arising from the assembly meeting are handed to the mayor. Mayor? Hey, how'd he get that gig? I don't remember voting for him. The title mayor would have to go in Matt Stoller's Utopia, and the incumbent of the role be entirely beholden to the people in Dave DeGraw's. Like with the revolutions we've read about, we're under no obligation to replicate their ideologies wholesale. We can democratically cultivate our world together. The Budget Council meets from September and the delegates, councillors and administrators work through the budget which is adopted by the mayor at the end of the year. Sounds like a lot of bureaucracy, and I bet it fucking is. That's what politics should be. Admin. No power, just clerical work, enacting the will of the people. The mayor doesn't get to make any crafty moves to help out his banker pals or get bikes named after him. It's just graft and service. The procedure is aided by a team of coordinators who liaise with the community throughout the process. Real-life democracy where the issues that you care about are addressed. Me, I don't see immigration as a real issue. For me, an immigrant is just someone who used to be somewhere else. And the sooner we unite and organise to dismantle the structures that prevent all of us being free, the better I'll feel. You might feel differently, though. You might want strict border controls like Bill O'Reilly or Nigel Farage. Now, whilst I'd argue that the only reason we even think stuff like that is because we've been given duff and manipulative information, you may not care. In a truly representative democracy, we'd be presented with the arguments, then we'd vote. If after all the pleading and exposure of actually culpable bankers and corrupt politicians, there was still a determination to blame immigrants, some crazy racist deal could be voted in. Given that we're all meant to be deeply apathetic, our refusal to vote regarded as slovenliness rather than an unwillingness to participate in a system that knowingly harbours and protects political paedophiles, the concern would be that no one would bother to take part in this new, empowering system. Well, 31,300 people took part in the process in Porto Alegre in 2002, up from 1,300 in 1989. This goes to show that participation escalates when people see that they're not wasting their time. Also, it clearly wasn't as boring as I was worried it would be. It caught on like Rubik's Cube, or if you're young, and I hope you are, Loom Bands. That's a huge number, positive in itself, but imagine the increased sense of community and connection. Compare this to what we're mugged off with by way of democracy. In London, 25 elected members of the GLA and the Mayor of London decide how to spend a budget of £14.6 billion. Sounds like there's a bit of wiggle room there. When this new type of democracy was implemented in Brazil, let's call it actual democracy, the majority of participants were women and poor people. Isn't that what we need in all democracy? Underrepresented groups to come to the forefront? I think our communities would greatly improve if more women and blokes that hadn't all gone to the same school got stuck into running them. What happened when they got involved in Porto Alegre? Spending on health and education rose from 13% to 40%. 98% of houses were connected to mains water and the sewage system. The number of schools increased by 4 times. That's what happens in representative democracy. People get represented instead of mad policies that allow spying, new water cannons, arms deals, and the carving up of health services. Generally speaking, when empowered as a community or common mind, our common spirit, our common sense reaches conclusions that are beneficial for our community, our common unity. Chapter 33. Worth voting for? These models already exist. They are already working. We know the current system isn't, not perfect but the best we can do. It's fucked and it's fucking us and it's obsolete. Now there are alternatives. We have the means, we just haven't used our power to assert our will. The technology that enables us to vote for TV talent shows can be used for truly representative, localised, democratic process. That's common sense. The trade agreements that benefit transnational corporations can be rewritten to provide food and resources for the people of the world. The utilities and facilities of major corporations, Monsanto, Apple, Time Warner, can be confiscated and given to democratic collectives so we can have food, technology and communication on a local level without needless global tariffs, Mickey Mouse product updates and senseless ecological damage. The US writer Walter Mosley said, "We have the formal structure of a democracy, but not the substance. The structures exist. The resources exist. The only thing that stands in the way of this necessary revolution is the venal entitlement and self-interest of the people who benefit from things staying as they are." Now, as David Graeber said to me once, these people aren't going to just stand aside, say, "We see your point, and let us get on with the revolution." When fear and propaganda finally fail and that process has begun, they will, of course, use force. Military force, police force, and private security. The good news is, as Che Guevara pointed out, that the people that do all the work in those institutions are getting shafted like the rest of us and will only go so far for a pension. Their compliance is kind of a habit. Habits are hard to break, but, and I know this from personal experience, you are more inclined to break them when they stop working for you. As the degeneration of our governing institutions becomes more blatant, more and more of the brave men and women that have sworn to protect and serve the people are going to see that oath runs directly adverse to what they're being paid to do. The battalions of ex-service people living on the city streets of the UK and USA are a cruel testimony to the true sentiments of our governments towards those that are willing to give their lives. 60,000 homeless people in the USA and 25% of all London's homeless have formerly served the country that now does them such a rank disservice. What would happen if we tried to create regional participatory democracy? What would happen if we tried this out in London, New York or Barcelona? What would it be like? What if in London we used the existing democratic structure to return power to the population of London? Every major decision within the current jurisdiction of the mayoralty could be voted on directly by the people, like in Porto Alegre. In actual fact, the Mayor of London, thank God, has only limited power, but we could all vote on issues that would immediately change the vibe of the place, like, should all development contracts given out by the Mayor and the City of London be to non-profit cooperatives whose workers elect their bosses and reinvest all the money they make in London and guarantee the living wage? One of the things the mayor could do, and the one London has now would never do, is only grant development contracts to ethical businesses that behave themselves. My feeling is, even with the above stipulations, like paying people properly, empowering your workforce, and responsible reinvestment, these exciting new enterprises could give snidey outfits like Boots, Starbucks, and Vodafone a run for their money.
Legal asterisk.
I'm not saying their products are substandard. I don't have a view on that. I'm saying that they, in collusion with a compliant government, avoid paying tax that pays for the social structures that allow their companies to profit. We, as a community, might prefer to get our stuff from outlets that aren't ripping us off and not contributing. I'd vote for it. Should all new housing developments be required by law to consist of at least 70% affordable housing? London doesn't have enough affordable homes. The Mayor of London could ensure new developers address this by building some. It would also go some way to alleviating the spiritual stain of urban homelessness. That'd be cool. Should we be arresting drug users? The Mayor of London has power over the Metropolitan Police Force and could ask them to stop bugging casual drug users. In fact, all drug users. The war on drugs has been lost. People take drugs, and that's that. All we can do is create conditions that are as safe as possible and result in as little criminal activity as possible for something that remains illegal. Most police I've chatted to think it's a ball ache nicking drug users and would be glad to drop it. We could have a vote on that. Should we abandon stop and search and the harassment of the homeless? This is another area where the mayor's authority over the police could save a lot of aggravation for them and the community. Actually, given the mayoralty's power over development contracts, how about a vote for the city's residents on this subject? Should all businesses granted development contracts support a city-wide fund to provide shelter for all? Imagine that. No homelessness. An end to the inhuman twitch required to steel ourselves for the guilty march past street sleepers. Should we subsidise the creation of democratic media and an online dialogue with the electorate? Even though 10% of Londoners don't have internet access, which seems mad to me in my bubble, it would be good if the relationship between city administrators and the electorate became complete and ongoing. In fact, given that one-fifth of the population are offline, how about city-wide free Wi-Fi for all residents subsidised by commercial and financial interests? The advantage of using the pre-existing infrastructure of a metropolis like London is it gives us the opportunity to demonstrate a new politics, a politics that spreads power as widely as possible and represents people directly. As we have seen from the US's treatment of any nation that tries to step outside of the capitalist paradigm, any attempt to reduce corporate influence and empower people is met by extreme external pressure. That would probably happen to any public official who sought to truly devolve power. That's why the chance this office gives to rally for wider change ought to be exploited. Regular referenda could be held to form a powerful people's lobby to pressure national governments and international organisations to align with the needs of the people they claim to represent. London could become a paragon of advancing consciousness, an awakened society that organises a good, fair, empowered life for its citizens and campaigns for global change for everyone. The ideas I've collated in this book are clear, simple, and necessary. This is continually obfuscated by the representatives of a dying system that requires our docility for their ludicrous prosperity. The feeling you have of anger is real and just. The feelings of hopelessness and despair are not. We all have a choice. We are the creators of our reality. All we have to do is make a decision to take collective responsibility for change. Do you really think that the revolution is a ridiculous proposition, that we cannot engineer our own structures? What's ridiculous is the system we have now. If we were starting society anew, who among us would propose a monarchy, an aristocracy, a financial elite that exploits the earth and farms its population? If at one of the local or regional meetings that we have to govern our community, someone proposed instead of equality that all of us, including the poorest among us, donated a percentage of our income to a super rich family with a little old lady at its helm who would just turn up annually in our parliament draped in jewels and finery to tell us that austerity had to continue, you'd tell them they were mental. If someone said that we should give 64% of British land to 0.28% of the population, we would not vote for it. If trade agreements were proposed that meant local businesses were shackled so that transnational corporations could create a farcical, tyrannical economy where produce was needlessly transported around the world for their gain and to the detriment of everyone else, it would be forbidden. If energy companies said they wanted to be run for huge profits without regulation whilst harming the environment, we wouldn't allow it. That pharmaceutical and food companies could run their own governing bodies, flood the world with inferior and harmful products that damage and even kill the people that use them, we would not tolerate it. Here is the truth that they fight so hard to suppress. To create a better world, the priority is not the implementation of new systems, though that is necessary. It is a refusal to cooperate with the obsolete and harmful structures that are already in place. The revolution will be easily enacted and beneficial to all. It is time to wake up. In a survey that YouGov conducted among non-voters that we paid for, and they still refused to skew, so it gave damned lying statistical answers, a third said they wanted outright revolution. 54% said they didn't vote because big businesses run Britain, and 96% thought the voting public had no influence at all on the way the country was run. Incredible that the vast majority of non-voters have found their way to the truth, given that 70% of the UK press is controlled by just three companies and have a vested interest in ensuring that this truth only appears fleetingly, usually masked by tits and bingo. Six corporations own 90% of all media in the US. If you want the truth, you're not going to get it there. The people that own the means for conveying information, who decide what knowledge enters our minds, are on the fun bus. My personal revolution is to live by spiritual principles and to serve this wider change in any way I can. It's early in the process for me, but my infatuation with fame is waning. My need for external approval and the control of other people's opinions is expiring. Practically, I've decided that profits from this book will go towards creating a place where recovering addicts like me can run a business based on the ideas in this book. A cafe and production company run to create community, not money, democratically managed by the workforce. No bosses, no profit, no bullshit. Selling food sourced ethically, grown locally, and served by people who've had a revolution in their own lives and are now able to learn and give back. Supporting modest creative projects, building a community of people who want to be part of something other than the toxic hegemony. We will start small, but we will grow quickly because we have a limitless resource and we are providing an alternative to a dying system. There are no limits to what we can achieve if we behave collectively, responsibly, and humanely. The world is changing and we are awakening. These statistics give us a numerical glimpse at the visceral dissatisfaction that most of us feel. Now is the time to express it. These corrupt structures cannot be maintained without our compliance. You could vote against them if there was anything to vote for, but there isn't. Or you could stop paying your mortgage, stop paying your taxes, stop buying stuff you don't need. When we, the majority, unite and demonstrate our new intention, we will be invincible. If we who are complicit by our silence become active and disobedient, this is a pivotal time in the history of our species. We are transitioning from an ideology that places power and responsibility in the hands of the few to one where we all collectively have power. It is important that we clarify in a manner accessible to all which institutions and systems are beneficial and which ones have to go. It is important that we propose ideas and systems that will be advantageous, like the handful in this book, and ensure they are presented properly. When they are inevitably disparaged by the fearful enemies of change, we must remain unified and insistent. At this climactic time, we have no choice but change. This book, written by a twerp with minimal interaction with brilliant thinkers and uncorrupted minds, demonstrates that. Now, what are you going to do about it?
Epilogue, for the benefit of the tape. I went back to Lakeside to see if its lustre remained or if it would be like meeting an old lover, the magic drained by time. Whilst it may architecturally resemble St Paul's Cathedral rebooted by a Kardashian, on arrival there's very little to slap nostalgia on. For a place so dependent on superficial splendour and opulence, it's peculiarly bleak, a barren edifice. The process of parking the car is almost enough to get your gander up. By the time we'd ditched the vehicle in a gloomy, low-ceilinged, multi-storey but no real plot car park, I was so irritated by the lack of spaces and incessant checkpoints that I needed to have a fight or buy a pair of trainers just to let off some steam. True beauty binds you to it. Ugliness in art, architecture or people makes you unwittingly recoil. When I watch a bit of shit theatre, suddenly I'm painfully aware that I'm in a humid room watching people gesticulate and gurn for no bloody good reason. They're just pretending, I think, and feel a bit embarrassed for me and for them. Where do I situate my nostalgia on the pitiless and blank walls of Lakeside? No concession to the human is made. I bet the corporation that built Lakeside and six malls just like it could just as easily turn their hand to building prisons. It's not a place for people, for public life. It's a vacuum in a suburb that empties more than your pockets. I ask one or two people why they're there, and no one seems to know. There is no purposeful stride, rolled up paper under the arm, fag on, tapping the hedge as you go, a sense of civic participation. This is mass hypnosis. When a pigeon flies in, it seems obscene, like an unzipped fly in a wedding photograph. What the fuck are you doing in here? Here the birdsong is piped in. The plants are doing their best to synthetically photosynthesize, but their hearts aren't in it as they pose in their Guantanamo urns. I can see the absurdity of the wayward bird or the indentured flora, but really their presence is no more ridiculous than mine or any of the others interned in this fluorescent vault. How sparse must our hope be to come looking here? What must I have been like to willingly subject myself to this context where nature itself seems superfluous, like pubes on a mannequin? A wrist-slashing adolescent escaped from pudgy and hysterical childhood until delivered into the secondary cradle of addiction. As hapless as the pigeon and as forlorn as Wilde in Reading Jail, without even the little tent of blue sky, we are severed from ourselves, severed from God. The geometry that Lakeside mocks, that's found in every church and mosque, is the material representation of the invisible connection that we've lost only to walk these glistening yards. Later, you will search Rice Resonance on YouTube and be shocked at the sublimely choreographed rice particles performing miraculous crop circles on top of a panel vibrating to a gradually increasing frequency. You will see that the invisible waves that sound is made of form the shapes and patterns that define our world, that perfect geometry fills the spaces between us. The unknown is constantly addressing us. It doesn't use our language, but it's here, quite clear, among us. N,N-dimethyltryptamine, DMT, a drug which I mentioned earlier, when administered in high doses, gives with eerie consistency to those who take it the experience of hidden realms where new consciousness is experienced. Beings are encountered that commune and reassure. DMT occurs naturally in many plants, all mammals, and in the human brain. No one knows its neurological function, but many assume it's connected to dreaming. Dreams, more immersive and psychedelic than any drug, and occurring whenever we sleep, unbidden, a nightly reminder that mystery reigns within. Incrementally indoctrinated, we have forgotten how to dream. We have forgotten who we are. We have abandoned our connection to wonder and placed our destiny in unclean hands. Look closely next time a world leader is on your TV. Look at their face from deep within yourself. Is that the face of someone you can trust? Either a mask of plasticine smugness, or wrought and befuddled sincerity, or smug bellicosity. Should we allow these men to govern? On I went to Grays and was actually a bit embarrassed by how lovely the library was and how sweet the people were, as in my head I'd rendered it as a suburban South Central with myself as a white iced tea. Nick, who was with me on leaving the Thameside Museum, judged it to be a centre of excellence, an estuary Oxford, Harvard with fake tan. In fact, I must mention that I was interviewed by the police during the writing of this book, and the WPC who questioned me were so resolutely lovely, judicious and kind, I nearly gave up on the whole revolutionary caper. There were cups of tea and codes of conduct and tales of public marches in her former life. In fact, though, this just confirms my thesis that people are beautiful and revolution inevitable. We don't need to grow compassion in a Petri dish. Everyone's fine. We just have to scrape away a few repellent systems. Thankfully, in Gray's Park, once we'd passed the immaculately tended roses, I ran into the now grown-up child of a girl I dated when I was a teenager. This child, now 20, had a baby of her own, making my former paramour a grandmother and me inwardly wince, and she looked like she'd had a hard time. In the short exchange between us, it was clear that in the intervening years she'd been subject to the ordinary tragedy that bludgeons normal people. The girl I used to date, who I remember as being imbued with a powerful and adventurous spirit, the kind of girl who's in grave danger in a small town, in Salem she'd have been burned, was in a wheelchair now. Administered the wrong drug at the wrong time by a knackered nurse during a routine visit, she'll never walk again. All around us, lives are squandered and dreams are unfulfilled. We condition our children and ourselves to enter into this spectacle, confining ourselves to a prescribed path. My mate Matt says that when he takes his 2-year-old son down the park, he has to fight not to impose a predefined version of the experience onto the spontaneous boy who, not knowing the script, may wander off after an ant or pick daisies when he's supposed to be playing football. Is there a limited number of times that a child will insist on remaining wedded to the moment? Do we eventually all become cowed and beat down and just sit in the swings like we're supposed to? Eckhart Tolle told me that to be free of suffering, I must, in the moment of temptation, when I want to yield to anger or jealousy or self-pity, to recognise that the ego that these fleeting interlopers serve is an illusion. When in conflict with a partner, I see myself as the sole defender of some superior truth, that I must impose this truth for some higher cause. I asked Eckhart why. "We adopt a mental position," he told me. "Then we identify with that mental position, and it becomes invested with self." The self is a construction. Some memories, some feelings, some opinions, a name, a bunch of photographs, real and imaginary. This conglomerate that we hold in our consciousness is temporary. It is an illusion. The boundless energy, the hidden energy that invisibly performs its geometric dance is real. The unified energy that is behind all diversity is real. The moment of conception, individual or universal, is real. Behind all phenomena, thoughts, things, animals, life itself, is an awareness. Move into this awareness, said Eckhart. When you are in conflict or doubt or afraid, when you lose hope or lose people that you depend upon, move beyond the pain and fear. There is an awareness there, an awareness that has always been there. In your loneliness and suffering and darkness and fear, silently behind it, the awareness is waiting for us to return. This awareness is the field of consciousness from which all life came. The absolute energy that precedes all and is beyond all and is within all. It is within you. We all have this in common, but we have been convinced that we are alone. But this energy that compels one cell to become two, that heals wounds, that spins quarks and planets is within us all. And all language can do is rest on top of it or point to it, never really describing it. This force, this undeniable compulsion to come together. We all know that it's there, and we all know when it's absent, and we all know that we must be open to it now. And in spite of its ethereal and indefinable nature, we all know that it's love.
We hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Revolution by Russell Brand. Executive producer Something Else. Text copyright 2014 by Russell Brand. Production copyright 2014 by Random House Audio UK. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.